email me at david.crowwithinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, or what you don't like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support that you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. A little bit of feedback. Emily Tarcell, who I interviewed about the death of her daughter, probably from the HPV vaccine. Thank you so much. You're quite an excellent interviewer, and I really appreciate talking with you. Thanks for the work that you do. I'd also like to thank Susan, who doesn't want her full name used, for recommending this week's guest, Wayne Squire. I had tried to contact Dr. Squire before, but it failed in my venture. But Susan managed to get us connected, and I appreciate that. There have been 3 tragedies in the news recently in Canada. There was the bus collision with a loaded truck that killed 16 people, mostly members of the Humboldt Broncos hockey team, but also some support staff, and injured 13 others, some seriously. One is now a quadriplegic. The Quebec City mosque shooting was back in the news because the hate-filled man, Bissonnette, who perpetrated the tragedy that killed 6 and seriously injured others, including another man who became a quadriplegic trying to save others. This man was on trial. And then there was another angry young man who drove down Yonge Street in Toronto, aiming for people and killing 10, mostly women, and injuring many others. He appears to have been angry at women for his lack of sexual activity, a so-called incel, involuntary celibate. Well, there are also comments from friends and fellow students that he was somewhat brain damaged, and we don't know if this played a role. One said that he was surprised that he would have even been able to drive a vehicle. After the Humboldt tragedy and before Toronto, a feminist, Nora Loreto, tweeted that it was the whiteness and the maleness of the hockey team that caused the outpouring of grief that eventually raised $15 million for the injured and the families of the dead. A lot of people looked bad after this incredibly insensitive remark, not just Nora Loreto, including those who tried to defend the remark, which is virtually impossible. But even worse were the people who attacked the writer with rape and death threats. It's true that our response to tragedies varies for a lot of factors, and some were ignored by Nora Loreto, including the youth of the people who died, that they were playing hockey in Canada, where hockey is the most loved sport, and not soccer or video games, that they were a coherent group, that almost everyone in the world has traveled on a bus on a rural road and can empathize with a boringly normal situation suddenly becoming tragic. Both the mosque shooting and the very recent Yonge Street murders have caused an outpouring of sympathy and significant money. Definitely not as much as in the case of the Humboldt tragedy, but I suspect that because the Yonge Street murders occurred in the middle of Canada's biggest city, that eventually they will raise nearly as much. Really, this is a stupid game to play until there is a tragedy where clearly not enough sympathy and money is raised, and there are lots of those in the third world, especially in the Middle East, where our money is being used to bring far greater tragedies through accidental bombings and shootings of civilians, and through the destruction of infrastructure. Now let's go to this interview regarding the medical and legal issues surrounding shaken baby syndrome. I'm sure you will find it very interesting and challenging if you have any remaining belief in this syndrome.
Dr. Wayne Squire is a pediatric neuropathologist based in the UK. There aren't a lot of people with this specialty. There was a time when Dr. Squire believed in shaken baby syndrome, including the so-called triad, but around 2001 she came across the research of Dr. Jenyon Geddes, indicating that these symptoms are due to lack of oxygen, not shaking. As a highly credentialed professional, her changed testimony carried a lot of weight in court, but then the pushback started against her. In 2016, she temporarily lost the right to practice, is currently allowed to practice, but not allowed to testify in court. Welcome to the show, Dr. Squire. I hope if it's okay to call you Wayne.
Yes, of course. Good morning or good evening.
Yes, we're in quite different time zones. So tell us where you were educated and how you became a pediatric neuropathologist.
My medical education was in the University of Leeds. I was a somewhat reluctant medical student. I wanted to do research to work out why things happened, how things worked. But I'm very pleased I did do medicine, and shortly after qualifying, did a couple of years of pediatrics. That's what I really loved. But discovered that I wasn't terribly good at the cutting edge of clinical medicine, and I preferred to do things in a more relaxed or perhaps a more thoughtful way where I had time to think about what I was doing and think about diagnoses. And I got into pathology and then neuropathology, which was absolutely perfect because it's a sort of reflective practice. And having always been interested in pediatrics, I was very interested in how the brain develops. So I was very fortunate to spend most of my life predominantly looking at the way the brain develops, how things can go wrong in pregnancy, at birth, and in the early years of life.
And so people think of a pathologist looking at slides, but I'm sure you look at patients as well. I mean, what kinds of evidence does a neuropathologist use when they're making a diagnosis?
Well, we don't see many patients. I did because I looked at muscle disease, and that involves seeing patients. But my predominant practice was looking at the brains of babies who've died. So I didn't have very much clinical involvement, except sometimes speaking to parents. But once I've looked at the brain and analysed what I can see down the microscope, the most important thing to do is to relate that to what happened in life. There's not much use in a pathologist sitting in an ivory tower writing fancy pathological terms. This has to be converted into something which the doctors treating the patient can understand and the parents and the family can understand.
Okay, well, let's move on to the so-called triad of the shaken baby syndrome, which I understand is bleeding behind the eyes, in the lining of the brain, and swelling of the brain. Is that an accurate
That's
description?
right. The swelling of the brain is rather imprecise. Sometimes people talk about encephalopathy, in other words, the brain's not working properly, which might mean the baby has seizures or is vomiting or is irritable. Or it can be very severe brain swelling, which may sometimes lead to rapid death.
Now, sometimes shaken baby syndrome is diagnosed in babies that have died, and I presume then, an autopsy is likely. But in a living baby, maybe a baby who's been injured or is ill for some reason, how easy is it to determine whether the triad is present?
Usually, what happens is if a baby is brought into hospital because it's not well, because maybe it's a bit sleepy or it's vomiting or even unconscious, one of the first tests will be a brain scan. And if that shows that there's some what we call subdural bleeding, that's bleeding around the surface of the brain, then that will all immediately raise the question of whether this bleeding is due to trauma. And if there's no evidence of trauma in terms of a history of being hit by a motor vehicle or falling or bruises and fractures, then the question is, could this be shaking? Is always asked. And the next test that's done is usually looking into the eyes to see whether there is evidence of retinal hemorrhage.
So blood behind the eyes, is that, or
That's
that's,
right. Yes.
And if you looked at some of these babies externally, would you see bruising or other signs of abuse, where the baby's being gripped or something else?
If you see marks on the baby, such as bruises, which are not readily explained, if there's no evidence that the parents say the baby was dropped while they were carrying him, or they fell downstairs holding a baby, or something like that, if there's no story that there's been any trauma, then you would be surprised if there are bruises. So, in other words, if there is evidence of trauma, bruises or fractures, or scratches or abrasions or cigarette burns or something like that, then it makes it fairly straightforward to think something has happened to this baby. We don't have an adequate explanation.
I guess the other side of the coin is, are there times where the triad is present, but there's no external signs of abuse?
Yes, there are, because a baby may have bleeding behind the eyes and bleeding around the brain without any without abuse and without trauma. And in fact, if we look at normal newborn babies, we know now that about half of healthy newborn babies have both of these signs. They have bleeding behind the eyes and bleeding around the brain.
Really, and these are normal babies with no signs of illness.
These are normal babies who've gone through a normal birth process, which is reasonably tough for a baby to go through. But this is what got me really thinking that if normal babies have these findings, maybe it's something that's there as a sort of safety mechanism. Maybe this is something that's part of the almost the normal physiology of a baby to withstand the processes of birth.
Well, yeah,
And
I guess to both the baby and the mother, birth is probably one of the mo physically most difficult things that they will experience in their life.
that's absolutely right. And clearly, when a baby's being born, the head goes through a great deal of pressure change and the chest is compressed. And when the chest is compressed, you can't have normal flow of blood in and out of the chest. And so blood might back up in the brain. And I think this is Mother Nature's way of protecting the brain during childbirth. And in fact, our studies on the membranes surrounding the brain have shown that the structure is different in young babies compared with older babies and children. So it looks as if there are facilities there in the anatomy of the membranes around the brain to allow bleeding to occur into them so that it doesn't go into the brain itself.
So in an adult, if there's bleeding like this, I presume this would be a pretty serious thing.
Yeah, the bleeding in adults is usually very different. In adults who've had head trauma, the bleeding we see, which is called subdural bleeding, is usually very thick, a big mass of blood, which tends to compress the brain because of the volume of blood inside the rigid skull. But these babies who have this triad have a thin film of blood. It's widely dispersed over the brain and it's only very thin. It's a totally different pattern of bleeding. And that's why we thought it must be a different cause.
And does this blood disappear in a normal baby? I assume it must if they're normal.
If we look at the follow-up studies, and there have only been about 20 or 30 babies in the world followed up with these scans, what ha with who've got these, I'm sorry, let me start again. There are only about 30 babies throughout the world literature who've been followed up with repeat scans to look for this blood after birth. And usually it disappears as far as the scan is concerned by about 3 months of life. However, when a pathologist is doing an autopsy on a baby who dies of some other cause, you can still see remnants of healing subdural bleeding in this membrane around the brain up to, 8, 9 months or so of life. So it heals up over a period of months.
So you would be talking about, say, a baby that died in a traffic accident, that if there was an autopsy, you might see some of these signs of bleeding, even though, well, I mean, maybe that's a bad example because you might assume that any problems in the brain, any differences in the brain are due to the accident.
Yeah, say cot deaths, where there's no other finding. In babies who die of cot deaths, they die suddenly, unexpectedly in their cots, and a percentage of those have got healing bleeding in the dura.
So around 2001, you came across the evidence of, I don't know how to pronounce the name, Geddes or Geddes. And what was it about this doctor's work that convinced you to change your mind on shaken baby syndrome?
Well, Jenyon Geddes was a highly respected colleague, one of the top neuropathologists in Britain. And she studied 51 babies who were thought to have been injured intentionally. And she said that the brains don't have any evidence of traumatic tearing of the nerve fibers of the brain.
Okay. So I guess if you imagine taking a baby and shaking it very hard, there's things that hold everything in place, and those would tear if you shook it hard enough to successfully cause these problems.
That was the hypothesis. And also, part of the shaken baby syndrome was that a baby, once it's shaken, will collapse immediately because the nerve fibers in the brain, which are connecting the various different parts of the brain, will be torn and they can't function. But she said, no, this isn't the case. These babies have got brain swelling. The fluid is collecting in them, as it does around an injured part of the body anywhere. And that this isn't necessarily due to trauma. Only a very few of her cases had any evidence of what could be traumatic tearing, a very small proportion. So she said that most of these babies just have brain swelling. So we can't be sure there has been any trauma at all.
Have there been physical studies? I seem to remember reading about an engineer who sort of did shaking with basically crash test dummies or something like that to try to see what the physical forces were and whether you could generate sufficient physical force, shaking an object the size of a baby.
Yes, there have been several of these studies. Interestingly, the first one, which is really the first time the shaken baby hypothesis was tested scientifically, was in 1987, which is a good 13 or 14 years after the hypothesis was first widely accepted. So it took a long time for anybody to get around to testing it. And they showed that if you take these crash test dummies and you shake them as hard as you can, you get less than half the force that you would get from dropping the baby from 1 foot. So, a roll off a bed would cause much more force than shaking as hard as you possibly can.
Okay, let me get this straight. So a baby that drops 1 foot, which is I know that at least one of my children dropped more than 1 foot and with no serious adverse consequences. A drop of 1 foot would cause double the force that you could get by shaking. Wow. And like I said, I presume that most babies, if they drop a foot, if they don't drop on something sharp, probably are unharmed.
That's correct. Yes.
I found babies, luckily, were relatively durable when I was in charge of them, which is a good thing. So these physical studies don't really support the idea. But another thing that I found in other discussions, talking to some people affected by shaken baby syndrome, is that often under questioning by the police or other people, a parent will say, "Well, when the baby didn't seem to be responsive, I picked the baby up and shook it," which I think is a natural reaction, right? If you think your baby's sleeping so soundly that you're not even sure that it's alive, you might pick it up and give it a little shake. But that's completely different in terms of the force.
That's absolutely right. I mean, first of all, parents at one time were told that this is what you should do. If your baby isn't responding, give it a little shake to try and stimulate it. Because babies, especially premature babies, sometimes do have periods when they just forget to breathe for a while and they need to be stimulated. And so that kind of resuscitative shake is nothing like the force that has been used in these experiments, where the people shaking these dummies found that after 10 seconds they could no longer shake because they were so exhausted by shaking a baby. So it's not resuscitated shake we're talking about.
Yes, but I think that what happens is that once a parent admits that, well, yes, I gave the baby a little shake, it sort of gets magnified into something that can be used to convict them
in
court.
I've seen that happen again and again and again. Yes.
Yes. Because parents are trying to be helpful and honest, and if they're asked, I mean, what would a normal parent do if their baby seems to be non-responsive? And I know in the case of my kids, sometimes they slept so soundly that it was difficult to see that they were actually breathing. And of course, as a new parent, you're paranoid about your baby. So
you're absolutely right. Yes.
You're likely to pick the baby up and shake, and then of course it starts to cry, and you go, okay, everything's fine.
I'll go back to sleep.
But in a case like this, it would be natural to give a shake, and then of course when the baby doesn't respond, then you start to panic, I guess. So prior to 2001, what was it that made you believe that shaken baby syndrome and the triad was a real thing that did indicate child abuse?
Because everybody believed it. It's what we were taught at medical school. It's what was in all the textbooks. It's what all my colleagues would, and many still do, believe. Mm. And it wasn't until I read the Geddes research, and then I read a lot of material about the Louise Woodward case, if you remember the Boston
yes.
nanny.
Mm-hmm. The nanny, yep.
Yep, and a lot of people in the United States came out in that case and said, no, this wasn't shaking, and started to challenge the shaking hypothesis. And then I got introduced to people like John Plunkett, who sadly we've recently lost, but he and others who were great leaders in this field and who were very inspiring. And I read the literature and talked to people and just realized there was nothing to support this hypothesis.
Yes. Well, let's move over a little bit to some of the legal aspects, because after you changed your mind, you continued to testify in these cases, but now you were testifying on behalf of the defense, on behalf of the parents, or whatever, whichever caregiver had been accused of shaking the baby. So what happened in those cases where you were, you were engaged by the defense to testify?
I just gave my evidence as best I could with the scientific backing, and now I had quite a lot of information which supported my my opinion, many scientific papers which I could use to back what I was saying. And I think people got quite angry with me. People who had established views on shaken baby syndrome didn't like a woman to come along and challenge them and say that they might have got things wrong.
Right.
And I particularly was the subject of harsh criticism in the family courts, because I think there it unsettled their sort of staid regime of having a team of experts who come in and say shaken baby syndrome every time. It's very straightforward. We do what's safe. We take the baby away. Then we've done our job. And
right.
The judges hated it because I was saying, well, it's not so simple. You've got to think again. There are other possibilities.
In The Guardian, the head of the General Medical Council, which was the organization that I believe took your license away for some time, he wrote, "The General Medical Council is not and has no intention of being the arbiter of scientific opinion. The allegations we brought against Dr. Squire did not rest on the validity of her scientific theory, but upon her competence and conduct in presenting her evidence in the courts. It is strange that eminent lawyers, in setting out their argument, choose to ignore the fact that no fewer than 4 senior judges had expressed strong criticisms of the way Dr. Squire had presented her evidence in court. These were in cases of the most serious kind in which the welfare and lives of children were at stake, as well as the liberty of individuals." So this, I've read this a couple of times, and it confuses me because there's really no description of what are these criticisms that judges were putting against you, and why did they get the GMC so upset?
Well, that's a very good question. The criticisms that were made against me were that I had made factual errors, and we managed to demonstrate during the course of my hearing that they were all, those criticisms were all completely invalid. We found the documentation which showed that I was actually correct in what mm-hmm. I had said. So these were actually errors on the part of those judges who had misread my report or had not read my report, or who had, for some reason, misunderstood something, so thought I had made a mistake when I actually hadn't.
This seems very strange to me. Ideally, a judge is a neutral party. I think anybody who studied the justice system in just about any country in the world knows that the ideal is not always achieved. But it seems strange to me that judges would overtly criticize an expert witness, because it seems like they're saying, I know the answer, I know the scientific answer, but then the GMC is saying, well, no, this is not a question of scientific opinion. But it is. They said, as I just quoted, the welfare and lives of children are at stake, as well as the liberty of individuals. So it's the scientific truth that resolves that issue, right?
Well, that's absolutely correct. Judges, of course, in the family division don't have a jury, so they have to make a decision. And in any case, they're going to make a decision, and then they're going to back that decision with citations, with the evidence from the case that they think supports it, so it's more difficult to appeal. So in any case, if you're an expert witness, you're going to be on one side or the other, and you're either going to be praised or criticized to some extent. But they were particularly angry with me, and it seemed they really didn't like me. Well, they said that I'm challenging the mainstream view, and they really didn't like that. They thought that I was some kind of a renegade, rather than maybe this is something inside.
And I'm thinking that one of the reasons why there was so much antagonism towards you is because of your status, in the sense that as a pediatric neuropathologist, there really aren't very many people who should know more about this than you. Like what specialty would know more about the triad of shaken baby syndrome than a pediatric neuropathologist?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I'd had something like 100 peer-reviewed scientific papers in my CV at that time. I hadn't just sprung up from nowhere. I'd been doing this work for 30 years.
Right.
And so I think the problem was that they didn't feel able to challenge my science.
Right.
So they had to challenge me and the way I said things. Sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm just completely befuddled by what this Neil Dixon says, because he's talking about your competence. But if this is, you know, how can you evaluate somebody's competence without, evaluating the scientific opinion, which the GMC says they're not going to do, and presumably the judges would say, well, we don't evaluate the science, we just evaluate the testimony of the various experts. Before experts like you came along to argue for the defense, I mean, you kind of alluded to the fact that in a case, all the experts would agree that this was shaken baby syndrome. So that would make the job of the judge very easy.
That's right.
I mean, I wouldn't be very difficult if I was a judge and, you know, two or three doctors say it looks like shaken baby syndrome. I'd be calculating how many years the caregiver gets in jail, and I'd be writing out orders for the children to be given to somebody else. So, I mean, what's your understanding of how a judge would deal with the fact that, say, one doctor comes up and says, clear case of shaken baby syndrome, and then you come in and say, well, here's the reasons why it's not. What's a judge supposed to do to evaluate the evidence in that case?
Well, way back in about 2003 or 2004, there was a case called Canning's in the United Kingdom, where the judge said, if the medical evidence is controversial, then it cannot go before a jury. Because if the doctors can't sort it out, how can a jury possibly sort out medical evidence? So we have to look at the other circumstances. We have to see what the parents are saying. We have to see what the social workers are saying. We have to see what the neighbours say. What is this family really like? Mm-hmm. So the medical evidence would be set aside. That's one way of dealing with it. And I think in the family division, it's been more difficult. And judges clearly don't want to be presiding over cases. We've had some very high-profile ones in this country where a baby The judge says, oh, this is fine, there's no evidence of abuse, sends the baby home, and then the baby is killed or
right. It seems like this social welfare system for children in the UK, in America, and Canada has extreme cases where babies are left in abusive situations until they die, as you pointed out, and in other cases where babies are taken away for seemingly completely innocuous reasons. I've heard of babies being taken away because the parents were vegetarian or something like that. There was a case in Canada, it was slightly humorous, where the parents were very religious and refused to talk about, they were foster parents, they refused to talk about the Easter Bunny because of their religious beliefs. And so the child services said, you're not going to get any more children if you don't talk about the Easter Bunny. Which is maybe a little bit humorous, but I mean, in cases like you're dealing with people going to jail for years, maybe life.
Yeah, or having their babies taken away from them, which is a tragedy for everybody. Just having your baby taken away is almost as bad as a prison sentence.
Yes, it could be conceivably worse. I mean, we're dealing with this in Canada with the Charles Smith. I'm sure you know about his tainted evidence. And also the Toronto Sick Children's Hospital was doing hair samples saying that mothers were drug users or alcoholics and taking children away. And then later they said, oh, all this hair sample testing is invalid. But people have gone to jail for 10 or 20 years before somebody says, sorry, very sorry. In the case of the JMC hearing, I read that 360 doctors wrote in support of you, and some of them were pretty prominent people.
Yes.
And that resulted in you getting your license back to practice.
Well, I don't know if it was their letter. I was absolutely delighted to have their support. And one of the things that kept me going over the almost 10 years that this process has been going on is that so many people supported me and said that they thought I was right and they agreed with my science. But I went to appeal in November 2016 and it was given my license back then.
But strangely enough, you were also told that for some period of time, which apparently is still continuing, you're not allowed to testify in court. I didn't understand how you can be licensed to practice, you know, considered an educated, experienced professional in this area, and yet not allowed to testify in court. Do you understand that?
Well, I don't understand the reasons. The reason the judge didn't just dismiss the case entirely was because apparently I had cherry-picked the scientific literature. He upheld that criticism, which means that when I looked at a scientific paper and took the data from it, the real hardcore evidence, that was not sufficient. I should have agreed with the conclusions of the authors of the paper. And sometimes that was irrelevant. It's only speculation. The real evidence in a paper is in the data.
I totally agree with you. I think there's a paper written somewhere that talks about how different the abstracts of papers are from the actual data of the paper, because scientists have a tendency to spin the abstract to make it sound better than the actual results are. And sometimes it's quite severe. You would think that you would be praised for actually reading the paper and not doing what so many people do, which is going on to PubMed or some other list of abstracts and just reading the abstract and never actually reading the paper.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it is critical reading. You look at the methods. If they're valid, you can accept what's in the data. And that's the point of the paper. That's all you need. You don't need the author's views.
Yes. That should be irrelevant. Like, read the results, read the methodology. And I mean, I guess it's important to look at the conclusions to see if you agree with them, but not be guided by the conclusions in the papers. Another strange thing that happened, and I think a lot of strange things happened, is that the BBC reported that in 2010, a policeman, Detective Inspector Colin Welsh, now retired, was at a shaken baby syndrome conference in the United States and said that defense witness testimony was at the, quote, top of the list as a reason for police losing child abuse cases in Britain. I mean, he called them child abuse, but actually you don't know that until somebody's convicted. That seemed a little bit scandalous. I mean, what can you say about Colin Welsh? Pardon, did I say Colin Webb? Colin Welsh, and how the police have acted in these cases.
It was absolutely extraordinary. I had done a number of cases, criminal cases in England of shaken baby syndrome, where I had been on the defence side and Colin Welsh had been the policeman running the prosecution case. So he obviously didn't like what I was doing and what I was saying. And he gave a lecture at a shaken baby syndrome symposium. The National Centre for Shaken Baby Syndrome have big meetings. He gave a lecture where he said, this is what we're doing to increase rates of conviction in the United Kingdom. And he said that we are going to target defence experts because they're bringing science to the courtroom and it's confusing for the jurors.
I can imagine science is confusing to a lot of people, because when you actually get to the real science, it's a lot messier than you read in a newspaper or magazine or here on television. But I mean, the job of the police is not to grab somebody and throw them in jail. The job is to evaluate some unusual circumstance, like an unexplained death, and to gather evidence, not to seem to have a single opinion.
Well, you're absolutely right. And if the science is confusing, then the role of the prosecuting authorities is to ask for explanations, to look at the science and to say, why is it confusing? Let's have a look at it and see what's there, and maybe there's something we can learn. But instead of that, they said, no, we just get rid of all the people who are defending these cases.
And I mean, there is this thing about proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I can understand them saying, well, if there's always a reasonable doubt, we would never convict anybody. But if there are no defense witnesses, no expert witnesses for the defense, then the individuals who've been accused are at a huge disadvantage. And that seems to be where this policeman was going. Is like, get rid of the defense witnesses, and then the parents are defenseless, basically.
Well, essentially, that's what he's done. He's succeeded. Because whether I have my license back or not means nothing at all to the police. They don't care if I'm practicing my regular neuropathology. But mm-hmm. He's got me out of the courts, and nobody else is willing to challenge these cases, particularly in the family division, because they're held in secret. So nobody can see who's saying what. So nobody will go there and risk their reputation by being criticised by judges behind closed doors. So there is nobody in the United Kingdom who is going to do these cases to defend families accused of shaking their babies. There's a cabal of experts who give evidence in these cases. They all believe in shaken baby syndrome. They're used again and again. And it's a dire situation for parents. And it's shameful for the British legal system. Mm-hmm. That we should accept that we have got ourselves to a situation where there is no defense. That's not what the legal system is about.
Yes. I mean, in a case like this where the medical evidence is going to be likely going to be what convicts or finds innocent somebody, not having an expert witness who can bring evidence you know, that may be in your favor is basically why have a trial. May as well just grab the parent and throw them in jail and not bother with the expense of a trial.
With the expense and the years, months at least, and years of the parents hanging on there, waiting, hoping to get their baby back and not knowing. And the courts and the lawyers in the family court saying, well, it's okay, we've got the best experts in the country giving evidence here. This is what we have. We cannot challenge it because they're the most highly regarded. Well, those experts giving evidence that is not founded in science, it's just the mainstream view, it's based on the fact that this is what most doctors believe. And that is what the judges are dealing with at the moment, and the families have to face that. And it's appalling.
Go ahead, sir.
A judge may not understand the science, but a judge can surely read a report which is based upon the fundamental statement that this is what most doctors believe and say, that's not science. That's just mainstream view.
Yes. If you look back at your medical education, would you say that much of your training was being presented with lists of facts, maybe with some rationale behind them, more than critical thinking? Like, here's a hypothesis, what's the pros and cons?
I think we had no critical thinking training at all in my day. I hope it's creeping into the syllabus now, but I don't think it's very common. And medical students have an awful lot to learn, so they need to memorize lists of facts.
Yes, which is both the strength and the weakness of medical education. I mean, you have to memorize the entire anatomy of the human body, the bones, the veins, the organs, things like that. Even if you were trained in critical thinking, there's still a huge amount of factual information that has to be memorized.
Yeah.
And so that would tend to make it easier to impose, you know, a dogma that's not true, but just widely accepted.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's what happens. So you can't question everything you're taught. But when I was teaching medical students, I said 50% of what we're going to teach you is wrong. We just don't know which 50%.
Yes, which yes, it's true. I mean, if I look, it struck me at one point that I was always reading articles that say, you know, now we know this, but 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago, they thought crazy things. But then I think, well, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago, they thought everything they knew was true. And today we have the conceit to think that everything we are currently taught or know about medicine or science is true. But I think people who are critical thinkers know that there's a significant amount that's not. And also with multiple forces, such as in this case, the legal system seems to be a big influence on shaken baby syndrome, wanting a sort of a simple way out of these difficult cases. In many medical issues, money is a factor. And I haven't really seen that here. It's not like there's pharmaceutical companies lined up, you know, wanting to sell drugs or anything. I mean, do you think this is one of those cases where the forces that are manipulating the system are not really money oriented, or is there a monetary issue at play here?
There certainly is an element of that, in that expert witnesses get paid to give their evidence. The way you get reimbursed in the United Kingdom is different, in that the prosecution seem to have more readily available funds than the defence. And we often find in criminal cases in the United Kingdom there will be many, many more experts for the prosecution than for the defence, because the defence has to go through an application process of getting permission to get experts, and some of the legal services have to pay through legal aid, and unless you can pay for this yourself, you're struggling to get an equal number. And I've been in cases where there are 20 prosecution experts and I've been the only defence expert. So there's an imbalance there, and people who regularly do expert witness work get quite well paid. I know some of them drive around in Ferraris and Formula One racing cars and so
really?
On, which you don't earn from an NHS salary. But there's more than that. There's being sort of more generally invested in the belief as well, and being unwilling to say, well, I could have been wrong. Maybe I should change my mind.
That's a very powerful factor. I mean, if a judge has been in charge of 100 of these cases and everything's just gone swimmingly, you know, with this sort of same belief system and finding a large percentage of these caregivers guilty, and then to have somebody to completely shake it up and then think, maybe all those people I found guilty, or maybe a significant percentage of them, are actually innocent, that must be disquieting for a judge.
I think it must be terribly disquieting, and I think it's probably just as uncomfortable for doctors, pediatricians. I don't think I would sleep at night if I thought I had made that many mistakes, and I think sometimes perhaps a matter of not even being willing to look at it. We cannot even contemplate the fact we've been wrong, so we just carry on the way
yes.
we are, because
And of
Be
course,
gentle, be attentive.
right, and the thanks from the prosecution and the big checks, I guess, help not have to think about the more difficult issues. How does this differ than in the United States? It seems like in the U.S., shaken baby syndrome is receding in terms of convicting parents, although it's certainly not gone yet. But it seems like in the United Kingdom, it's still pretty much a dogma.
I think there are still plenty of people being accused in the United States, and even worse, there are people on death row. People
right.
have sentenced to death for shaking babies, which is a pretty bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
There also have been cases overturned quite regularly
right.
in the United States, and judges making statements like, this is a belief system, it's an article of faith, not scientific fact. So those judgments are very helpful, but we don't seem to be getting them in the United Kingdom.
Yes. So somebody, I mean, what would your advice be to somebody in the United Kingdom who is accused of shaking a baby? Is there anything they can do to try to not become a statistic?
Well, what they need to do is make sure they've got a lawyer who understands the issues. They need to have a good lawyer who knows about shaken baby syndrome, and they're few and far between. They need to inform themselves and understand that there is a controversial issue here, and to try and find out what the scientific literature is, and to try and find somebody perhaps in the United States who will come over and act as a defense expert.
And they either have to pay this themselves or they have to convince the government to pay through basically legal aid, right?
Yeah, if they've got a good lawyer who understands the system, then legal aid should be available, and they should be able to get a lawyer who will get the appropriate experts and can defend the case.
Have there been some recent acquittals in the United Kingdom, or has it been pretty much all convictions?
There are, I think, fewer cases in the criminal courts now. There have been some quite remarkable acquittals. One recent case of a very young mother and father who were about 16 or 17, and the mother did the research herself and identified Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. She said she bled easily, she had a family history of people bleeding, bruising, and they did the genetic testing, and they managed to prove that the baby was affected by this disease. And she was acquitted, but it
Wow.
was the mother who had to do it, and their baby was taken away for some 8 months.
And this was a 16 or 17-year-old?
Yeah, a girl, you know, who left school with no education. She made her own diagnosis. And it's shameful that the experts in that case were all asked, did you think of this? No, never heard of it before. And she was the one who was educating them.
That is incredible. Almost unbelievable. Kudos to that young lady.
Yeah. I should send you the judgment. It's worth reading.
Yes, I would really like to see that. I had one more question. Do you have any things that you feel that you need to get out in the remaining minutes of our interview? Things that we haven't, issues that we haven't covered?
Well, I think the thing that grieves me most of all is what's going on in family courts. Certainly in the United Kingdom, they're held in secret, and they use a system of single experts to represent both sides of the argument, and that cannot be just. And I think we need to be sure that the judges in the family division are aware that the science is changing.
And
they have to look at new evidence.
In family court, I presume that the punishments that can be given to the parents are basically limited to loss of the child. Like, there are prison sentences possible in a family court?
No, they usually run a criminal case alongside or after the family decision. But the family courts have a very low standard of proof. It's only, you know, more likely than not. And taking a baby away is no light decision.
No, I'm not making light of it. I wondered if they were kind of retreating to the family courts because they weren't so able to win in criminal courts. But if there's a criminal case, I mean, if you've already lost your child, assuming that the judge or jury know that, that's pretty damning. You know, that will be taken as a proof of guilt.
Oh, well, I think they try very hard not to allow that information in front of the jury.
Okay.
They try and keep them entirely separate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, often after a family court, there will be a criminal hearing. But the family court ones are the ones that really bother me, because it's a life sentence for that baby to be taken away from your family.
Yes, and even in cases like I was saying with these hair sample cases in Canada, even when it takes so long before the mother or other caregiver is found to have been falsely convicted, to get your children back is sometimes impossible. Or there's so many years have gone by that it makes family relationships very difficult.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And we had a case recently of a vitamin D deficient baby who was taken away by the family courts. By the time the criminal prosecution came up and the really red hot lawyer demonstrated the vitamin D deficiency, this was the cause of the fractures, the baby had already been adopted out, and the parents then get her back ever. So, you know, it's a terrible system.
Yes. One last thing that you talked about, I think it was Geddes who said that the triad is probably caused by a lack of oxygen. You talked about this genetic defect in vitamin D deficiency. What are some of the reasons that you believe can cause symptoms like the triad in some of these cases that have occurred? Do you have hypotheses about what was the cause of death or the cause of injury?
Well, in many cases, there's a history of a roll off a bed or a drop, a low fall. And many of these babies have got some bleeding still there from birth. And I think that might be something which predisposes them to do much worse after a low fall than an infant who doesn't have that. And we've written papers about this, why that might be the case, that the baby is sensitized. I think many of these babies choke. The parents give stories which are identical stories from parent to parent of a baby vomiting, milk coming out of the nose, going rigid and then collapsing. Parents can't make this stuff up. Mm-hmm. And most of these babies also have old bleeding. So I think those are two things. I think venous thrombosis, the sort of blood clots you get in your veins when you sit on aeroplanes and so on.
Yes.
Well, these can happen around the brain as well, and they're quite common in young babies, and they will cause the same symptoms and signs. Blood clotting disorders, and then, as you say, vitamin D deficiency and so on. There are a number of relatively common genetic conditions.
And do these experts for the prosecution, make at least pay lip service to going through some of the other potential causes of the same symptoms? Or do they say that there's nothing else that can cause this identical triad of symptoms?
There tends to be a battery of routine tests that are done, and they say, well, we've checked blood clotting and it was all normal, and we've checked this and we've checked that, so now we think it's abuse. There's the sort of blinkers go on and we stop doing any other tests. And those routine tests aren't good enough. You can't just do an x-ray to see if the baby's got weak bones. You can't just do a routine blood test to see if there's a congenital clotting disorder. You can't just do a routine scan to see if there's venous thrombosis. You need to do very specialized tests, and they're simply not done in the vast majority of these cases.
When will you be allowed to testify in court again?
I probably won't. I can go back. It will be another 18 months before I would be able to go back into court. But in fact, I've handed back my license. I got it back, and then I decided I'm going to stop practicing as a doctor. I'm retiring. And I think, should I walk into a courtroom, I would have such a great big target painted on my chest.
Yes. It wouldn't be much fun. Yes. I mean, would you consult with lawyers or people like that? Maybe not at the level of an expert witness, but I'm sure you have a huge amount of knowledge on this subject that you could share with lawyers or parents.
I would be absolutely delighted to consult with people. As you say, I've done a lot of work on this. I'm still writing papers. I'm still doing some research. I am always happy to offer whatever help I can, because I think these parents are in such a dire situation that anything that I can do to help,
yes,
I do.
I think there's a lot of myths in our society and one of the myths is that the courts are there to find truth, that science is there to find truth, that medicine is there to find truth. And that's sometimes true, but sometimes it's the exact opposite, which seems to have happened in this case.
Well, you're absolutely right. One of the most shocking things I heard was from my own lawyer who was representing me when I went through the GMC process. And one of the first things he said to me was, "I am not a seeker after truth." Now, I should have probably worked out then and said, "I'll run this case myself," but it would have cost me millions. But that's the legal position. We are here to win a case. We don't care about the truth. And that is very, very worrying.
I mean, having a single expert witness, seems like a good idea, because if an expert witness is a completely neutral party, he's going to evaluate the evidence on both sides. But what you are saying, and what has also been seen, such as in the Charles Smith case in Toronto in Canada, is that there is this desire to win the case on the parts of the police, on the parts of the expert, the pathologist. I mean, that's not right, and I don't think we want to think our society is run that way, but it seems to be.
Yeah, I'm afraid that that is the case. I mean, I've seen it demonstrated in a meeting where the police stood up and said, "We've got our best medical expert here," and brought a neurosurgeon onto the stage and said, "This is the man who does our cases for us." Absolutely stitched up as somebody who's there as a police prosecution expert.
Who's always reliable, always giving the same evidence slightly related case. There, it's been discovered that in Canada, the insurance companies have favorite doctors to give testimony that no matter what kind of a traffic accident you're in, you're fine to go back to work, and you don't need any money from the insurance company. And they basically have pet experts who they throw a few thousand dollars at them, and they parrot out the same evidence, even without looking at the medical records in some cases. Which is shocking, but that's how the system has worked too often. I would like to thank you for joining me today. I don't know if you have any last words to add to this very important topic.
Well, I think that the only words are that it's just heartbreaking to know or to imagine what it must be like for a family where this happens, where you have a sick baby and you're shocked that your baby is sick or dying, and then you're accused of harming the baby. And for an innocent family to go through that must be just absolutely heartbreaking, and it's something we must try our best to prevent from happening.
Yes, and for a doctor who entered the profession to help people, it must also be difficult to see these cases happening.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the conversation today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to episode 180 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's PATREON. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.